Now we have spent an hour in meditation mode, in the sitting and walking and standing postures, giving this mind a rest from thinking. Not giving up thinking altogether, which would be more of a jhana practice, but instead letting the thinking process slow down by directing our thoughts to focus within the narrow confine that I suggested for you of being aware of the physical body. The Blessed One has given many different subjects for meditation, such as awareness of body, awareness of Vedana, feeling, awareness of states of mind, awareness of the various dhammas, doing contemplation on the decomposing corpse, doing contemplation of the internal organs of the body, and so on like that. And then also contemplation to develop the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity for all beings in the world. Contemplation which is aware of the existence or non-existence of the hindrances, the factors that block our meditation and prevent wisdom from arising. Contemplation or awareness of the bodhjhanas are the mental factors that support meditation, with the inclination, in the case of hindrances, to prevent and drop the hindrances, and the inclination to recognize, value, and sustain the factors of enlightenment which are supporting our practice. Many different objects of meditation, and I would encourage you to stay with root practice, whatever is a strong, easy and stable practice for you that you have learned in meditation, and also in a methodical way to study, learn, and try out some of the different kinds of contemplations that are offered for you in the Theravada. When you develop all these various forms of meditation, you can be like a skilled cook who has many different kinds of pots and pans and different types of knives and spatulas and spoons and a wok and a fry pan and a steamer and all these different tools. And then according to what is needed at the moment, the skilled cook can use the right tools at the right time to get the job done. So then if you are in a state which is very sleepy, for example, you might be inclined to do some type of meditation that's more active to overcome drowsiness. Or if you're in a state of mind which is quite agitated, you might try to use a more forceful type of concentration practice to try to lock down your awareness and overcome the agitation. So, for example, something like counting breath is a practice to just help you to settle the mind when the mind is very agitated. If the mind is both reasonably energetic and reasonably peaceful, then that's a really nice time to relax and practice some type of open field of awareness, simply being present, keeping the mind centered and balanced in the middle, and being aware to just see whatever comes up, whatever arises to our attention, without needing to have a fixed anchor of the attention. One is able to just have open, floating awareness, simply staying within the present moment and being there to see the arising existence and passing away of the various phenomena that might come into the mind. All of these are good practices for the cushion practice. And you might then ask a question. The topics that I began speaking about this morning and that I'll speak about just now and this afternoon are so theoretical and conceptual. What's the linkage between these two kinds of practice? Wouldn't it just be enough not to have to learn all these lists that the Buddha gave, but just to simply sit and have a simple mind and watch the breath? If anybody here is got the luck to be a Buddha, you could be what's called a Pacheka Buddha, which somebody you can become enlightened by yourself. You don't need any advice from anybody. You can work it out. But you don't necessarily need to be able to be a Sambuddha and be able to, again, turn the wheel of Dhamma and convince the whole world about it. You're just able to practice within yourself, and you have that talent, to the gift to be able to sit and realize. Many of us, most of us in this era, are what they might call savakas. We listen. And we are lucky that we can still be in contact with the teachings that were passed down by a Sama Sambuddha, a perfectly enlightened Buddha who was able to realize for himself the way out of this nest of suffering that we're in, and to convey a certain set of principles or concepts that we can then take as our toolkit and use them to point our mind in the direction to realize that might be beyond what we could have figured out all by ourselves. The end goal in both cases, whether we are reflecting about a teaching that has been handed down, or whether we are reflecting and experiencing what is just arising directly to our own natural experience, the goal is to break through from being locked into this grasping mind, the mind which is perpetually dissatisfied with the present moment, trying to get something better, trying to hold on to what we seem to have, trying to stop the tides of change and to be in a simple state of what is for our welfare and for the continuation of our process of life. It's not that we're trying to become zombies that are disconnected from this actual world of the human life process, but instead that we're striving to be within this human life process, but we've activated a kind of a wisdom factor that then becomes an important part of the committee in our head, so that even while we're doing the things that are necessary to do in order to live, in order to do our work, in order to keep our promises, in order to overcome our problems, even while we're going through all of that, while we have our emotional reactivity and our whole psychology, everything that we inherited when we took a human birth and we got the typical set of faculties that a human being has, there's a part of the mind that is able to stand apart from all that and to observe it and to see it's just a process of life. And can stand back at a level of tranquility, ease, stability, peace, and freedom, even while we have to go to our board of directors meetings, and even while we have to take care of fixing things and solving our problems. So the ti lakana, the three marks of existence, are a set of concepts that the Buddha suggested to us that we could develop in our mind in order to give us a different way of looking at the things that we naturally experience. In the there's a sutta called Girimananda Sutta, which is a very famous sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. It gives a set of 10 different contemplations, or I should say perceptions. Girimananda was very ill, and the Buddha invited him to develop these 10 perceptions in order to overcome his illness. And he did develop these 10 perceptions, and he was cured of his illness and was able to continue his life. And it's because of that that in some of the traditional Buddhist communities that Girimananda Sutta is used for people who are sick. They chant it as a way of like encouraging people who are facing illness. So among the 10 perceptions, he encourages to develop the perception of impermanence, dukkha, or stress, and anatta, or non-self. I want to now talk to you about what I think would be a practical approach to what they mean by developing a perception. So we might think at the beginning of simply studying and listening to Dhamma explanations, Dhamma teachings by teachers, and studying what's given in the suttas or in the old texts about a particular theme. So we could say, here is impermanence, anicca. The Buddha said, all conditioned things are subject to anicca. Everything is changing. The Buddha said, even at the kind of a cosmic level, if you imagine Mount Meru, which is the sacred mountain, so that would be the tallest mountain in the world, if somebody rubbed the top of the mountain with a feather, and then eventually the mountain would be worn down and be worn away into nothing. And so that's a kind of slow process of change, which is still impermanent. So even this world, as we have seen, to our distress and our regret, even our physical ecosystem is subject to change. And under the burden of human activities, this change of our physical world is accelerating in a frightful way. We can see that nature itself is constantly changing. In the ancient times, human life was much more on the edge of survival than it was in our more recent historical times. There could be forest fires, floods, droughts, heavy raining seasons with torrential monsoons, and so forth. And so the changes of the natural world were perceived as being a danger. Now, in another kind of a way, when we see the impermanence in nature, some people may think that it's sort of lovely, beautiful, pleasant, and nice, like if you were to go to the beach and look at the sunset on a clear night, and there's something like a magical moment that this particular sunset is only going to happen one time, and here you are just in this moment, just experiencing the particular combination of everything right there, and it's so beautiful, and it seems to be even more precious, more poignant, and more lovely, exactly because it is impermanent, right? The reason why impermanence sometimes seems painful, depressing, difficult, and stressful, and sometimes seems to be poignant and lovely, I think has to do with whether we're getting involved in something being a threat to our existence. So whether there's some identification that relates to our own personal survival. Being in nature can be quite healing and relaxing in the sense that most people will think that the sunset is not their personal property. They don't have that identification with the stars. Those things are something larger than our individuality, and we're able to, in a certain way, when we're communing with nature, we can let go of our clinging to our individuality and be relaxing as just being sort of like part of nature, without that grasping or that identification. But as soon as the change then is something that is an existential threat, something that is relating to our survival, our existence, our identity, then it becomes challenging and stressful in a whole different way. I live in a forest up in Sonoma County near Jenner, where we were given just over 100 acres of forest that was empty and started building cabins. There was a time when our little community or monastic community was planning on what to build and where to put things. And I asked one of my colleagues if she would visualize and imagine what our monastery would look like, what would come to mind for her. And she said, well, I would visualize that it's all going to fall apart and go back to dust. So this is great. You know, if we can hold that point of view, we won't have to be stressed about it. But if we hold the point of view that this is like my empire, and like, you know, I have 8 cooties or eight cabins, and then I have to maintain eight cabins. And just this past weekend, I had a guest who's an elderly nun, and her heater didn't work properly, and I had to switch out that heater for that heater to give her a functioning heater. And so it's all of this work to maintain what we have. And so in that way, impermanence then becomes stressful, because nothing that we own can be held in a way that's static. It all has to be dynamic. It's continuously changing. So you have to either be growing or shrinking, or you have to be coming or going. You're not really able to stand still in the samsaric world, the world of this human endeavors. They say that one reason why there's so much war in the world is because it doesn't really work out for a country that wants to be a military power to just have a big army, which is just sitting there marching around or something, that they have to use the army. Otherwise, they're going to lose their military power if they don't use the army to do something with it. And so a country that wants to be a world power has to like assert its power, and or else it's either going to be getting more powerful or it's going to become less powerful. And becoming more powerful is always a lot of work, and becoming less powerful is painful in a different way. This is the way, some of the ways in which we can see that impermanence is a constant fact of life at a kind of a global or a big scale or a gross level. Another common way that we see impermanence at the gross level is in terms of our own lifespan and the physical state of the body. So if we are older, we might have noticed that our physical abilities may start to decline, that we may have aches and pains that we didn't have before. Whether we're old or young, we might have to face the reality of injuries or illness, and know that in the foreseeable future that we're going to become much less capable than even than we are today. Eventually the body and the mind possibly deteriorating and losing capacity, finally ending in death. So this is a huge problem for people who take a kind of a naive point of view. Even though we know in theory that there's such a thing as death, somebody might not actually realize that it's a real thing that applies to me. Even when I was 40 years old, my younger brother passed away, and you know, I had seen my grandparents had died, and that seemed kind of normal. But to lose my younger brother was a really shocking, traumatic thing, because at some kind of like a deep, like psychological level, my identification of like who I am is, I am this child who's got a position in the family in relationship to my parents and my brothers and sister. And so then to have part of my family taken away out of sequence was like having my arm cut off. And it was so just really surprising. And so in just this way, people might be in denial about their impending doom. And so the contemplation of impermanence will include contemplation of the inevitability of death and the inevitability of disease and the decay and decomposing of our physical faculties. So a first level of developing a perception will be this idea of studying and thinking about it, what my teacher Bhante Gunaratana calls thinking meditation. So it would be not completely out of line if somebody spent some of their meditation hours actually thinking about a Dhamma topic. Then, having gotten an idea established in the mind, and the next level, I believe, will be to take this concept and try it on. So, having heard something and having learned it and gained a reasonable exception that concept that, okay, this may be a valid theory, then try to then incorporate and apply this idea as this is the lens, this is the special pair of glasses that I'm going to use to examine my experience. And so then going through all parts of our life, including our meditation on the cushion time, as well as the rest of the day, and noticing all the different instances that we can see what is this phenomenon of impermanence, and look at how we experience it in reality in our life. Then, once we have done that for some time, what can happen is that the perception of impermanence can be like a kind of a second nature, that because we have thought about it and because we've applied it in our life, that will be the idea that springs to mind whenever something changes in life. Instead of seeing, oh no, my car is broken, we would see, this is impermanent. So the first thing we notice is impermanent. And then the second thing we might notice is all the other consequences like that. You don't have to take the car to the shop. Once that perception has become rather habitual, then we have the opportunity of taking it into, like, deeper into the subtle aspects of what we're able to experience within meditation. So that, for example, if we're sitting on the meditation cushion and applying the mind to our meditation object, we might be able to notice that with the faculty of touch and the physical flow of the breath, there arises, and the touching consciousness, there arises this contact. And from the contact of the breath with our body, in our awareness, there arises a feeling, which is based on that touch contact. And then if the contact stops, the feeling stops. When the contact starts, the feeling starts. When we feel some pain, when the consciousness is connected with the feeling faculty associated with pain, the feeling of pain is present. If the consciousness shifts and stops attending to the pain and starts thinking about lunch, then the feeling, depending on the pain, stops. So we can see this arising and cessation of a feeling at a very rapid pace based on the touching of our sense faculties and consciousness, touching on their relevant objects, and the Vedana that arises from that, the feeling that arises from that, and possibly other kinds of mental phenomenon, such as perceptions and volitions, can be arising based on that touch. But especially in the realm of feeling, we have this opportunity to observe Vedana and how changeable it is. How the Vedana is always coming and going and coming and going based on the impingement of sensory objects on the sense gates. And so then we can experience impermanence at this profound and subtle level. And now we're getting into the realm of being close to liberating wisdom. So again, just to summarize what I'm trying to convey in this little talk, is that for each of the three marks of existence, I'm recommending that you would try beginning by studying and learning and thinking in an intellectual way about what the meaning of impermanence, stress, and non-self is. Then having learned it and thought about it, then you would try to carry this awareness around with you and your practice in your daily life to see how that phenomenon is manifested in your daily experience. Having made a particular way of looking at things very habitual, very actually strong, you've taken your weapon of mindful awareness and looking at things a particular way, and you've made it very sharp and accurate. And then you can bring your developed way of perceiving into a good, solid meditation practice and observe the subtle processes of this body and mind as they're manifested within meditation. And now I'm going to come to a close of this simple instruction, and it will be time for us to take our meal. Lots of sense contact in the meal. Great opportunity to try to be aware of how many changes you can notice in your body-mind, especially in your feelings, associated with anticipating lunch, receiving lunch, and eating lunch. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to take a 1.5 hour break and be here, ready to get back to work at 12:30. If you finish your meal early, please don't waste the time. And I even would suggest avoid the bookstore. Or if you want to go in the bookstore, then do it with full awareness and mindfulness and know, why is this body and mind not willing to stay in the meditation retreat but wanting to leave the retreat in order to be entertained by looking at books? Okay, so that's my talk for now. Mm-hmm.